Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is your Foreign Exchanges World News Roundup for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. Let's get into it. We've got a couple anniversaries, as we always do. On March 5th in the year 363, the Roman Emperor Julian, who was later dubbed Julian the Apostate, since he has the distinction of being the last non-Christian Roman ruler, led his army east to invade the Sasanian Persian Empire. Roman invasions of Persia generally turned out to be mistakes, and although Julian was a skilled military commander, this campaign was certainly no exception. After some initial successes, Julian gave up his plan to besiege Ctesiphon, and instead he led his army on a fairly aimless march through Mesopotamia, harassed the whole way by Persian forces. He died of wounds suffered at the Battle of Samarra in June. The army then chose his successor, a general named Jovian, who unsurprisingly ordered a prompt retreat back to Roman territory. Somehow don't think he would have been made emperor if he had not promised to do that. On March 5th, 1770, British soldiers, confronted by an angry mob in the city of Boston, opened fire on the crowd, killing five people and wounding another six in an incident that became known as the Boston Massacre. Although it took place 5 years before the start of the American Revolution, popular imagination has closely linked the massacre to the war. Crispus Attucks, said to have been the first person killed when the shooting began, became immortalized as the first person killed in the Revolution. Moving on to the news, in the Middle East and Israel-Palestine, negotiations toward a Gaza ceasefire broke off on Tuesday without a deal, with both Hamas and the Israeli government seemingly more interested in blaming one another for the lack of progress than in actually reaching an accord. Despite public pronouncements from the various outside participants in these talks, the U.S., Qatar, Egypt, about signs of progress, the combatants seem to be disputing the same issues they've been disputing for weeks now: the length and nature of the ceasefire, possible relocation of displaced civilians back to northern Gaza, etc., which to my admittedly untrained eye suggests they haven't made any progress at all. The rhetoric coming out of the Biden administration, most recently from Joe Biden himself, is also not terribly promising in that it also seems more geared toward blaming Hamas for the failure to achieve a ceasefire than in actually achieving a ceasefire. In other news, the U.S. military made its second airdrop of humanitarian aid into Gaza on Tuesday. I haven't seen any word on how many meals were involved this time around, but unless it was several orders of magnitude more than in the initial drop on Friday, which was 38,000, and that would be logistically impossible, it's not going to change anything about the situation in the territory. There have been reports of multiple children dying of starvation over the past few days, which likely means that the territory is no longer on the verge of famine and is, in fact, in a state of famine. Mahmoud Mushtaha at Plus 972 magazine has collected the accounts of survivors of last week's flour massacre in northern Gaza. It may surprise you to learn that those accounts do not correspond with the claims the Israeli military or IDF has been making about that incident. Okay, maybe that won't surprise you, where the IDF has insisted that its soldiers only fired warning shots to try to disperse a chaotic crowd. These survivors are quite clear that the soldiers fired directly on that crowd. Where Israeli officials say their soldiers opened fire in response to a stampede, the survivors indicate that the gunfire caused that stampede. A United Nations expert report published on Monday finds, quote, reasonable grounds to believe, end quote, that acts of sexual violence were committed against Israeli victims on October 7th and have been committed against hostages in Gaza since then. The report cites, quoting again, credible circumstantial information, and specifies that it was not based on any victim interviews. The report is contributing to the recent debate over what really happened on October 7th, fueled by serious questions surrounding the New York Times claim that Hamas, quote-unquote, weaponized sexual violence on that day. The UN report doesn't go nearly as far as the New York Times report did in its conclusions, but it suffers from a similar lack of direct evidence. The Israeli government recalled its UN ambassador on Monday while insisting that despite publishing the report, the UN is trying to silence claims regarding alleged October 7th-related sexual violence. The UN Human Rights Office reported last month on what it said were credible allegations of violence, including sexual violence, against Palestinian women and girls by Israeli forces and while in Israeli custody. For some reason, that doesn't seem to have gotten as much attention as the October 7th claims. In Lebanon, an Israeli airstrike killed three civilians in the southern Lebanese village of Houla on Tuesday, according to Lebanon's national news agency. Hezbollah said that it fired dozens of rockets into northern Israel in retaliation. At least 51 civilians have been killed by Israeli attacks on Lebanon since October 7th. In Iran, the NGOs Iran Human Rights and Together Against the Death Penalty issued a joint report on Tuesday revealing that Iranian judicial authorities executed at least 834 people last year, the highest number of executions they've carried out in a single year since killing 972 people in 2015. The Iranian government clearly used the threat of execution as a tool to suppress the Mahsa Amini protests, though it also reported a higher than usual number of drug-related executions, and that may indicate an increase in illicit smuggling from Afghanistan and or Pakistan. In Asia, in Nepal, at the Diplomat, the Asian Society Policy Institute's Rishi Gupta offers some context to the recent political shift in Nepal, which we covered in last night's newsletter. I'll read you a bit of his piece. The Left Alliance government is back in Nepal for the third time. The Maoist center-led government broke ties with the Nepali Congress and has allied with its former arch-rival, the Communist Party of Nepal Unified Marxist-Leninist, or CPNUML. The two other parties to join the coalition are the Mahdesh-based Janta Samajwadi Party and the debutante Swatantra Party, following an 8-point deal. It will be the third alliance government formed in Nepal since the National Assembly elections in November 2022. With a history of short-term governments in Nepal's 15 years of democratic progression, the current reconfiguration is no surprise, and it will be no surprise if the Maoists get back again with the Nepali Congress in months and years to come. Power sharing, political discontent, ideological differences, underperformance, and pressure to restore Nepal to a Hindu state, a long list of reasons reportedly forced the Maoists to sever ties with the Nepali Congress. While the Nepali Congress expected the Maoist leader and current Prime Minister Pushpa Kamal Dahal to leave the alliance, it did not expect an overnight turnaround. This is me again. The new governing coalition apparently augurs a shift in Nepal's foreign policy orientation away from India and toward China, given Beijing's established affinity for Nepal's communist parties. Though, as Gupta notes, this new government may not be in place long enough for such a shift to take hold. In the Philippine government summoned the deputy chief of mission at the Chinese embassy in Manila on Tuesday to complain about what it called aggressive actions by the Chinese Coast Guard in disputed waters in the South China Sea. Chinese vessels in recent days have reportedly forced two collisions, damaging one vessel belonging to the Philippine Coast Guard, and injured four people aboard a Philippine supply boat with a water cannon. These incidents have taken place during another Philippine mission to resupply its makeshift base in the Second Thomas Shoal. In Africa, in Sudan, Sudanese Foreign Minister Ali Sadiq Ali told the Russian media outlet Sputnik on Tuesday that Sudan's military government has agreed to, quote-unquote, indirect negotiations with the Rapid Support Forces, quote, through the mediation of Libya and Turkey, end quote. Apparently, this is the product of discussions held at the recent Antalya Diplomacy Forum in Turkey. Sadiq Ali insisted that any new negotiations would have to build on rather than supplant the agreement that the military and RSF reached in Jeddah last year, which quickly broke down. It's unclear whether the RSF is similarly inclined toward talks, particularly if they're to be held on the basis of a deal that was reached before the paramilitary group had seized control of the Darfur region, as well as several other parts of the country. In Mali, at Africa as a Country, Mohamed Issouf Ag Mohamed and Mariana Brax Fonseca look at what the Malian government and its affiliated mercenaries are doing to communities across northern Mali. Read you a bit of their piece. As the eyes of the world are focused on the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the military that controls power in Mali is taking advantage of the situation in the Middle East to discreetly exterminate ethnic minorities, using the fight against terrorism as justification. In this context, against a backdrop of major political crisis and growing international isolation of the military junta in power in Bamako, the Russian mercenary company Wagner arrived in Mali in December 2021 to help the military junta in its anti-terrorism fight. Since then, extreme danger has afflicted the Fula, Tamashek, or Tuareg, and Moura populations of northern Mali. In September 2023, the military junta decided to launch operations led by men from the Russian Wagner militia. The mercenary groups used Turkish drones from the company Bayrak with high destructive potential, targeting those it treats as terrorists, including not only the representatives of the former armed fronts, who were their partners until the beginning of this attack under the Algiers peace agreement signed in 2015, but also the Fula, Tamashek, and Moura. Military actions amounting to ethnic cleansing of minorities are underway, combined with discriminatory propaganda calling for violence against and persecution of all civilians who wear turbans or other clothing typical of nomadic populations. Violence does not spare the elderly, women, and children who have their homes burned down and their land, livestock, and little wealth stolen. In Nigeria, Islamic State West Africa province fighters are believed to have been behind the kidnapping of at least 47 women in northeastern Nigeria's Borno State on Friday. All had apparently left their displaced persons camp near the Cameroonian border to collect firewood. On to Europe. The European Union, groups, the bloc's executive arm, the European Commission, on Tuesday introduced a new plan intended to bring the European Union's military spending back to Europe rather than spending it abroad. According to the Commission, since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, EU members have spent a collective 100 billion euros on military acquisitions, and nearly 80% of that was spent outside of Europe. Most, in fact, was spent in just one country, the United States. The project calls for increased investment into European manufacturing capacity and could be viewed as part of a broader initiative to reduce Europe's military dependency on the U.S. In Russia, the International Criminal Court on Tuesday issued warrants for the arrest of two senior Russian military officers, Sergei Kobylash and Viktor Sokolov, over alleged war crimes related to attacks on civilian utility infrastructure in Ukraine. The effect is symbolic, but it will likely prevent either man from traveling to any ICC member states anytime soon. One assumes those states would have fewer reservations about arresting one of them than they've had about arresting, say, Russian President Vladimir Putin. In Ukraine, the Ukrainian military says it sank the Russian patrol boat Sergei Kotov in waters off the Crimean coast on Tuesday. Ukraine's military intelligence unit apparently attacked the vessel with seaborne drones. The war is not going Ukraine's way on land, but it has inflicted a number of losses on the Russian Navy at sea in recent weeks, having sunk a landing ship and a corvette in several incidents, in separate incidents, in February. Its main weapons in this arena have been a couple of domestically produced surface drones, the Magura V and the Sea Baby. In Sweden, new Hungarian President Tomas Suljok signed off on Sweden's NATO accession on Tuesday, which leaves only some paperwork standing between Stockholm and full membership in the alliance. The Hungarian parliament, of course, voted to ratify Sweden's accession last week. It's conceivable that Sweden could be formally inducted into NATO by the end of this week. Moving on to the Americas, in Peru, Prime Minister Alberto Otarola resigned on Tuesday following the leak of an audio recording that purportedly implicates him in corruption. Otarola insisted that the recording, which was made when he was out of government, had been manipulated to discredit him. The entire Peruvian cabinet must now resign by law, but President Dina Boluarte can retain as many ministers as she would like. In Venezuela, that country's government has set July 28th as the date for its upcoming presidential election. President Nicolas Maduro will presumably be running for re-election against, it's not really clear at this point since Venezuelan authorities are still barring joint opposition nominee Maria Corina Machado from electoral politics. Opposition leaders had requested a date later in the year, in part to give them time to decide how to proceed if Machado cannot run. In Mexico, a roadside bomb killed three farmers in Mexico's Michoacán state on Tuesday. This is the second such incident in Michoacán in less than a week. You may recall from Friday's newsletter, and it appears to be linked to an increasingly violent battle between two cartels for primacy in that state. In Haiti, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry, to be specific, turned up in Puerto Rico on Tuesday after spending a couple of days in apparent limbo while the country he's supposed to be running devolved into chaos. Henri was in Kenya on Friday to sign an agreement that he hopes will clear the way for an international intervention to deal with Haiti's out-of-control gang violence. But he's apparently taking his sweet time coming home, which may have something to do with the fact that gangs in Port-au-Prince have joined forces and launched a major offensive aimed at removing Henri from office. On Monday, they launched an attack on Toussaint Louverture International Airport in Port-au-Prince, which, if successful, would certainly make it more difficult for Henri to fly back to Haiti anytime soon. It's not entirely clear where Henri has been spending the past 3 days, and he has yet to actually speak publicly on the situation in Haiti. Interestingly, his flight on Tuesday was headed to the Dominican Republic before it diverted to Puerto Rico, possibly because the Dominican government has now closed its airspace to Haitian flights, and Henri may have been planning to return to Haiti from the DR. And finally, in the United States, at Informed Comment, Juan Cole offers his latest assessment of the Biden administration's handling of the situation in Gaza. Let me read you a bit of his piece. The known deaths from starvation of Palestinian children in Gaza hospitals rose to 16 on Monday. This is a fraction of the actual such deaths, since Israel has put most of the Strip's hospitals out of commission and many infants and children are dying of malnutrition at home. In February, Israel let only half as many food and aid trucks into Gaza as it had in January, with UN and other aid workers warning that mass starvation of 500,000 people is imminent if these policies continue. The response of some in the Biden administration to do an end run around President Joe Biden's studied unconcern with these child deaths by joining in a Jordanian airdrop effort ends up being more a public relations effort than an effective food provision strategy. On Sunday, the U.S. airdropped 38,000 meals for 2.2 million people, which is like putting a Band-Aid on an amputated leg. Airdrops are costly and inefficient and would be rendered unnecessary if Israel allowed in sufficient food aid and actually began governing this territory it militarily occupies instead of playing shooting fish in a barrel with it. Although the Biden administration says it has pleaded with the fascist government of Benjamin Netanyahu to allow in more food trucks, the U.S. doesn't have to beg. The Israelis ran out of ammunition a long time ago and can only continue to bomb and shell Gaza because Mr. Biden supplies them with the requisite rockets and shells on a daily basis. After the Israeli government promised to let in more flour under mild U.S. pressure, fascist finance minister Bezalel Smotrich said that he personally intervened to sequester the flour and keep it from going into Gaza. Unless Biden cuts off the arms supplies, his PR pleadings that he wishes Netanyahu and his black shirts would behave more humanely are just bunk. And that's a good place for us to end tonight. Thanks to all of you for reading and or listening to the newsletter. And thanks especially to those of you who are Foreign Exchange's subscribers making this newsletter possible. Until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.